Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Fly the friendly skies. You are now free to move about the country. We love to fly, and it shows. Pick your airline slogan, people, but the government has pretty much had it with all the mergers going on. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 13th of August. Pleased, as always, to have you with us. Used to be you needed most of the fingers on both hands to count the number of major airlines in this country. And then Delta merged with Northwest, United merged with Continental, ditto AirTran and Southwest. And then all of a sudden there were five. The plan had been for American and U.S. Airways to get together too in an $11 billion deal that would have been part of American's path out of bankruptcy protection. Until the Justice Department today said, nuh-uh, it's an antitrust case the government is bringing. The DOJ says the merger would, and here I quote, eliminate competition and put consumers at risk of higher prices and reduced service. Those are pretty strong words, especially since all those other mergers were somehow okay. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman starts us off.
It's time to make a change.
A promotional video introduced the merger back in February.
The new American is arriving.
Well, not so fast. Antitrust lawyers at the Department of Justice worry that fare increases and canceled routes could result from reduced competition. For instance, the combined American-U.S. Airways would control more than two-thirds of takeoff and landing slots at Reagan National Airport,
which is a slot-controlled airport that politicians use.
Daryl Jenkins of the American Aviation Institute says the DOJ may be sensitive to that kind of dominance of air traffic in the nation's capital. But aviation analyst Michel Merluzeau says this isn't just about competition in Congress's backyard.
I think there are some other routes that are also of concern. Charlotte to Dallas, for example, and Phoenix to Dallas. You know, the major hubs that are currently served by either U.S. Airways or American Airlines.
He says the smaller cities that you get to from those airports could see service cuts and higher fares. But some of the same competition problems came up when United and Continental and Delta and Northwest merged.
So you just don't want to be the last one.
Antitrust lawyer Mark Ostrow has seen latecomer mergers blocked in the cell phone and disk drive markets.
The agencies count number of significant competitors, and when the number gets too small, that's when they step in.
He says too small is three or four, which is about where we are with airlines right now. So U.S. Airways and American may simply have to go it alone in an increasingly cutthroat industry. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Looks like Republicans in the House of Representatives might not need to keep voting to repeal Obamacare. The White House is doing a fine enough job delaying the thing all by itself. Last month, as we told you, the administration pushed back by a year to 2015, the part of the law that will eventually require that larger employers offer insurance to full-time workers or pay some fines. Now news of another big delay. The cap on out-of-pocket spending for consumers will also kick in 2015 instead of next year. From the Health Desk at the WHYY Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein explains what that might mean for consumers and for Obamacare itself.
Back in September 2009, President Barack Obama was selling health reform hard. And in a speech to Congress, he made this promise.
We will place a limit on how much you can be charged for out-of-pocket expenses, because in the United States of America, no one should go broke because they get sick.
5 years after that speech, plenty of Americans are still going broke.
About two-thirds of personal bankruptcies were attributed to medical bills.
That's about 600,000 people, says Christina LaMontagne with the consumer advocacy group NerdWallet. She says another 56 million struggle to cover their healthcare costs every year. LaMontagne says delaying the out-of-pocket cap, which is about $6,000 for an individual, nearly $13,000 for a family, only puts more pressure on people who are sick.
For starters, patients may delay or not get treatment because they can't be sure how much it's going to cost them.
The rationale for the delay? Some businesses need more time to prepare for complicated out-of-pocket calculations.
It's a very small number of people will be affected by this.
That's MIT health economist John Gruber. He helped write the law. But even if this doesn't have much impact on consumers, Gruber admits the mounting number of delays undermines people's faith in Obamacare. He says the administration is making a political calculation.
They're saying, look, we'd rather face the political price now of people giving us a hard time about delay than over the next year be killed with a steady drip of stories about how the out-of-pocket max isn't quite working correctly.
But there could be another price, says NerdWallet's LaMontagne. People may wait a year for the cap to kick in to sign up for insurance. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, down early, up late, which is, I suppose, better than the other way around. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Washington has gained some ground against the banking industry this summer. Former Goldman Sachs trader Fabrice Tour was found liable for misleading investors in a bond deal a couple of weeks ago. And there have been reports out there for days now that prosecutors are set to arrest two traders suspected of fudging numbers in the London Whale fiasco. That's the one that cost J.P. Morgan $6 billion. The Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, wants the bank to admit wrongdoing and pay a fine for that particular transaction as well. So, winning streak for the government or just getting lucky? Here's Sally Herships.
Banks and bankers, just those who are inclined to get in trouble, watch out. Dan Werner is an equity analyst at Morningstar. He says all these lawsuits and investigations mean a new mood in Washington.
It does represent a stronger thrust from regulators and behind them, I would say probably a stronger thrust from Congress.
To hold players accountable for what happened with the financial crisis. When it comes to punishing banks for misbehavior, fines have been a really popular option. So far, SEC actions have cost companies over $2.7 billion, but bank profits dwarf that.
Banks have seen these fines as a cost of doing business.
Nick Verbitsky is the filmmaker behind Confidence Game, a documentary about the collapse of Bear Stearns. He says fines to banks are like parking tickets to UPS. They won't change a company's behavior.
You might do a very unethical deal that could run afoul of regulators for $1 billion, but if you pay a $100 million fine, there's still $900 million in there.
Verbitsky says what's more important is the SEC's new strategy, pushing J.P. Morgan and other banks to admit wrongdoing, which could mean pricey civil lawsuits from clients and shareholders. Criminal charges from the Justice Department could be an even stronger deterrent. But is it the banks that should be punished?
Just making the banks suffer even more hurts the people who own those banks.
James Angel teaches finance at Georgetown's McDonough School of Business.
Those banks are owned by you and me. It's our pension fund. You know, it's our 401k that are the biggest owners of these banks.
Instead of banks, Angel says human beings should be prosecuted, like former trader Fabrice Tour. Prosecutors have also convicted several people of insider trading, but most are small players. So are regulators making progress against the banks?
We'll believe it when we see the convictions.
One big player who apparently won't be tried, the London Whale. The former J.P. Morgan trader is cooperating with the investigation. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Duke Energy is the biggest electric power company in the country. It got that way most recently by buying Progress Energy last year for $32 billion. It's got challenges to match its size, Duke does, not least of which is the changing energy industry in America. Lynn Good is the woman running Duke Energy. She became the CEO on July the 1st. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here today.
So it's been, what, 6-7 weeks or so? How's it going so far?
It's going very well. It's been a very hectic 6 weeks, though, I have to say.
This is, I think it's fair to say, an interesting time to be in the energy business. I mean, there's fracking going on. There's consumers trying to reduce their energy use. I want to run through some of the challenges that you face as the person running the biggest power company in this country. First of all, the fracking issue. How worried are you about where that's going to take the country and what it's going to mean for your business?
So fracking has been a real technological change that has caused great innovation in our business, and we've had the benefit of very low gas prices for our customers as a result of that. And so that trend is going to influence the way power is generated, at least into the foreseeable future. But just as I think about diversity of fuel sources, there may be another trend that we face over the next 10 or 15 years that we also need to be positioned to take advantage of.
What are you thinking of in terms of another trend? I mean, it's not nuclear, right? You decided not to continue with Crystal River and your nuclear plant down there. So what's it going to be, do you think? Wind, solar, what?
You know, I think it could be a little bit of all of those things. I think the degree and the pace of technological innovation in our industry is increasing. You talked about fracking. We also have renewable generation sources, solar prices coming down, mm-hmm. energy efficiency standards that are impacting the way customers use electricity.
Energy efficiency, you sort of blew by that one. But energy use, I think in your last earnings report last week, you said energy use for your customers was up just 1%, which does not seem to me to be a solid way for you to make a whole lot of money.
You know, energy demand has been a challenge, really dating back probably to 2007 and 2008 when the economy took, you know, the downturn. Mm-hmm. We have been recovering, but not at a pace that you might expect. And so I think the new normal for the industry is moderate, very moderate.
Where do you go from here, though, in terms of consumers? I mean, consumers are in this economy still feeling squeezed. They are not enamored of electricity rates and what they have to pay every month. How do you convince consumers you're in it for them?
That's a really good question.
Or maybe you're not in it for consumers. Maybe
absolutely
you're in it for
in it for consumers.
Okay.
Right. We provide a service that is so vital to our communities. We're a driver of economic development. We're really a driver of the success of the communities that we're in. So our focus is to deliver the service that we deliver with the highest degree of reliability and at the lowest cost possible. And I don't think that mission will change. And it'll become increasingly important as we move forward and try to address the challenges we just talked about.
Let me try something with you that I have tried with a number of CEOs in the past that I've had on the broadcast. And I will tell you in advance, it's more difficult than you think. None of them got it right. So with that setup, here you go. Describe your company for me in 5 words or less.
Industry-leading innovative energy company.
Industry-leading innovative energy. Boom!
How about that?
A winner. How about that? There you go. All right, good. With that, I'll let you off the hook. Lynn Good at Duke Energy. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much.
Coming up,
the unit has all the fixings house hunters crave: flat screen TVs, granite countertops, and a bathroom for every bedroom.
It's a dorm room, you guys, for college kids. But first, let's do the numbers. Positive retail sales news helped push markets higher today. The Dow Industrial is up 31 points, about 0.2%. Closed at 15,451. The NASDAQ added 14 points, 0.4%, ended at 3684. The S&P 500 gained 4 points. That's 0.25%, finished at 1694. We told you about the government's effort to block an airline merger. No surprise, aviation stocks went into a tailspin. Shares of American Airlines parent company gave back 45%, 4-5%. U.S. Airways descended 13%. Even their rivals took a hit. United, Continental, and Delta each fell more than 7%. Today, Southwest slipped 1.8%. For the second day running, tech stocks boosted the Dow and the NASDAQ. Hewlett-Packard ticked up 2% today. China's slowing economy hit Yum Brands. The owner of KFC, Pizza Hut, and Taco Bell said July sales over there fell sharply. Today, Yum's shares fell 2%. banks bounced back the day led by Citigroup's gain of 1.7%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.72%. It's been a long time since we've seen the yield that high. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Labor Department issues its monthly producer price index for July. It's where you can find Material Girl clothing. Macy's is scheduled to report quarterly earnings. And on August 14, 1935, President Roosevelt signed the Social Security Act into law. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. We learned today from TransUnion, the credit reporting people, that the number of Americans behind on their credit card payments is the lowest it's been in nearly 20 years. Marketplace's Adrienne Hill channels her inner game show host to find out why that is.
Thank you so much, everybody. Let's play a little Family Feud. Name the reasons people are more likely to pay their credit card bills on time. Greg McBride from Bankrate.com.
The improving economy.
Show me improving economy. Nice, Greg. When the economy improves, more people have more work and more money to pay their bills. Makes sense to me. And now John Oldsheimer from SmartCredit.com. We're looking for the reasons people are more likely to pay their credit card bills on time.
Reduced balances.
People carrying less debt on their credit cards, making it easier for them to stay current. Show me reduced balances. Good, John. And now Ezra Becker from TransUnion. Do you have an answer for us?
Prioritizing cards.
Prioritizing cards, huh? Before the recession, people were more likely to pay their mortgages first. Today, they're paying their credit card bills first.
If you stop paying your credit card within 3 months, that account's going to be closed and you won't have access to it. But if you stop paying your mortgage, foreclosure time periods are upwards of a year.
Okay, show me paying credit card bills first. And number four on our list, when we ask people why they're more likely to pay their credit card bills on time, less credit available. That'll do it for this round. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Say what you want about Congress today or how lazy the younger generations are or even how we don't really make anything in this country anymore. But the fact is that for centuries, America has thought of itself as something different. American exceptionalism is the phrase you always hear. In his latest writings, Charles Murray from the American Enterprise Institute puts that characteristic into historical context, how the idea took hold. It happened in part, he says, because of how hard we worked. His new book is called American Exceptionalism, An Experiment in History. Mr. Murray, thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much, Kai.
This industriousness, you write, was noticed even by European observers. You say that they came over here and they said, we have never seen as busy a people. They have constant activity, you said.
Constant activity, and to the point that it seemed a little unseemly to a lot of them, that Americans worshipped at the shrine of mammon, I think one of them said. And others looked at it more positively, but they all agreed that Americans were caught up in work and getting ahead unlike any other people in Europe.
And it persists to this day. We work, you know, 2,000 hours a year. The Europeans are on vacation all of August, you know.
Oh, Kai, we are a shadow of our former selves.
Really?
We still work more than the Europeans, but we work less than we used to in the 20th century and way less than we used to in the 19th century.
What happens when industriousness, as we see today sometimes, does not pay off the way it used to, where, you know, an honest day's work does not get you into the middle class?
Oh, boy. You're raising, I think, probably a topic on which we disagree.
Well, that's fine. Let's disagree, but it's an interesting observation.
Well, no, my own observation is that hardly anybody these days works as hard as they could, and the few who do have it made. I'm not talking now from statistics. I'm just talking about observation that employers yearn for people who work really, really hard, and they do get ahead. I think there has been a cultural change in the way we look at this constant activity that used to be such a central part of American life.
It's important, I think, not to gloss over the truly egregious parts of American exceptionalism. And you lay these out in your book.
Yes, I take a couple of pages and I say, look, here are the people who criticize American exceptionalism. This is what they say. They say, look, you're ignoring slavery. You are overlooking not only racism, you are overlooking sexism, you are looking in all sorts of ways in which the United States acted just like any other empire. And all of these are points that are reasonable to make. They should not overshadow the historical reality of the uniqueness of the United States.
I flipped, as I often do when I read a book, I flipped to the end to see you where you wound up before I actually finished this thing. And you kind of left it up to us. You said, you know what, you need to think about what America has meant in history so that you can decide the future of American exceptionalism.
Yeah, this is for college students, and it is not an attempt to propagandize them into becoming libertarians like me. I've tried very hard to make it a statement that professors who teach courses could say is an accurate statement of American exceptionalism, whether you agree politically or not with the author. Different folks will say getting rid of some of the aspects of American exceptionalism is a really good thing. That the reduction in religiosity is not bad. It is actually religion plays a reactionary role, and it's good that we're becoming more secular. It's good that we aren't so obsessed with work. Those are all arguments that can be made. What I'm saying to my reader is you've got to decide what you think about, which are losses to be mourned in the reductions in American exceptionalism and which are marks of progress to be celebrated.
Charles Murray is a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. His most recent book, I guess it's a monograph you could call it, is called American Exceptionalism, an Experiment in History. Mr. Murray, thanks very much for your time, sir.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
It's long about that time of summer where college students are heading back to campus. Dorm living, communal bathrooms, lousy food, or not luxury student housing is all the rage, it seems. Luxury, just for instance, meaning movie theaters and tanning salons. But as with all things luxurious, this kind of housing is not without its costs. From KBIA, Christopher Husted reports.
College juniors Allison Rabel and Jen Croft have just moved into their brand new apartment. It's just off the University of Missouri campus here in Columbia. The unit has all the fixings house hunters crave: flat-screen TVs, granite countertops, and a bathroom for every bedroom.
And once we got here, we took a bunch of pictures in front of the door.
With our new neighbors.
And we met a neighbor while we were doing that.
We met a lot of neighbors, actually. Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, we ran around and we were like, oh my gosh, come look at this. Oh my gosh.
Rabel and Croft have access to rooftop pools with adjoining bars, fitness centers, cardio studios, and a private shuttle, all part of the package of living at a Brookside complex. Here's Croft.
Like, it is more expensive, and every time I tell people my rent, their jaw drops a little bit.
Rabel and Croft's apartment runs about $725 per bedroom, then an extra $35 a month for furnishings and another $55 a month for parking. That's fairly expensive for Columbia, but Rabel says being a block away from campus is what really sold her on the apartment and that she's lucky to have parents help her with rent. These resort-style complexes are attracting a lot of attention nationwide. The problem some critics have with this housing is that it implicitly segregates students based on affluence. Laura Hamilton teaches sociology at the University of California, Merced.
The increased building of these upscale communities surrounding college campuses sort of falls in with the trend of what some people have called the country clubization of college.
Hamilton followed the trajectory of 53 college women over 5 years. She says the students who couldn't afford to live in fancier housing felt alienated.
It does create this segregation effect in the sense that these students are able to create exclusive social networks with people that are just like themselves, and those social networks are often used after college.
Hamilton says students in more modest housing typically are either left behind or burned through student loans to keep up with their wealthier counterparts.
I really feel that our students are less willing to defer that gratification. They've grown up in very nice homes for the most part. That's what they want now. They don't want that in the future.
That's Frankie Miner, the director of residential life at the University of Missouri. He says he has encouraged developers to look at more affordable housing.
No parent wants to deny their son or daughter what they want, but the question is, can you really afford that?
So what role do universities have in the business of off-campus housing? Sarah Goldrick-Rabb researches educational policy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
University officials can encourage or discourage local businesses from creating housing for their students that they think is, you know, consistent with what they want to have for those students.
But she says, let's face it, these upscale complexes attract wealthier students who end up paying more tuition and becoming big donors. In Columbia, Missouri, I'm Christopher Husted for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, which comes with the observation that it's been a busy day for what are commonly called activist investors. First, a guy named Bill Ackman, who runs a hedge fund called Pershing Square Capital Management, was squeezed off the board of JCPenney this morning. It's kind of an inside baseball thing involving who's actually going to run that struggling retailer. But it does get me to the juicy bit of today's activist shareholder news. Carl Icahn, who I think we can all agree is activist shareholder extraordinaire, tweeted this afternoon. We currently have a large position in Apple, Mr. Icahn said. We believe the company to be extremely undervalued. And he went on, spoke to Tim Cook today. Icahn apparently wants the company to buy back more of its stock, which, on the news that Icahn is in the Apple game, rose almost 5% today. Two tweets from one guy, Apple adds $17 billion in market cap. Just like that. Capitalism is amazing. And with that, we are done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow up 31 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ added 14 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 gained 4 points. That's about 0.25%. Right there. Thanks to Justin Ho and Katie DeLong on our morning report crew. The interim producer of the Marketplace Morning Report is Sean Bowditch. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.